Augury is a wonderful word, by the way. In Italy, if somebody's having a birthday or you wish them well, you say auguri, which is from the Latin, which means good auguries. May people's guesses about the future, good guesses, come true. So auguri for the United States, and watch out for this president. Now, what was your question?
What does this new Bush term bode?
I should think it bodes for the destruction of the United States of America. Certainly, the Republic, as we understood the Republic, based upon the Constitution of 1789 and the Bill of Rights, has been pretty much shredded over the last 5-6 years. Can't blame the Bushes entirely for this, because things have been going wrong for a long time. I would like to point out there is no war other than the one that the president unilaterally is waging against two weak countries against a weak political system, weak Congress, which does not protest. Only Congress may declare war. Congress hasn't. They've given him certain powers along the way. But this is not wartime. He says, I'm a wartime president. That means I can take your money, and I can lock you up, and I can do anything I want, and I'll send you to Guantanamo if I feel like it, and I think you're a terrorist. Now, we have a fool like that in charge of us. The surprising thing about the last election is the way that it went. I would have thought, since at this moment, something like 56% of the American people think we should never have gone to war in Iraq, and those numbers were rising as the election drew near, I would have thought we'd be voting against this war, because it is simply a Bush war. It has nothing to do with the American people. We were never in danger from weapons of mass destruction. We are not in danger, really, from anybody except an administration that has fallen in love with war because of the special powers that it gives the government to do whatever it pleases, getting rid of the Bill of Rights, due process of law, locking people up without telling them why they're being locked up, not only foreigners, but Americans here. I mean, this is the most illegal series of events in the history of the United States. We've had some hairy times in the past, but nothing to compare to this. So what have we to look forward to? Well, like everybody else, I've been following the Iran caper, which I have been predicting for quite some time. Now, that was on the drawing boards, contingency plans, as they call them at the Pentagon, that we would go after Iran. They've got a lot of oil. They have a lot of enemies among neoconservatives who have pretty much taken over the Pentagon and the running of the war. The president doesn't seem to understand what is happening, or if he does, he is really culpable. And here we are going to start a war in the middle of one that isn't a war, but people are dying, so that is a bellicose situation and a tragic situation for those at risk. So instead of talking about how the hell we get out of the mess that we are in the Middle East, specifically Iraq and Afghanistan, we're now talking about going into Iran, which has been a dream for some time of the oil and natural gas hustlers who have seized power in the United States of America, now govern us through a brain-dead Congress, all of their party, paid for by corporate America, and a Supreme Court, which is not interested in justice and will not check in on this issue. We have no weapons left, legally, so the Constitution is gone. Where would you turn? And I ask anybody listening to this, you were really in trouble, whom would you turn to? Well, your congressman isn't going to help you. He's helping out General Motors or whoever paid for his election. You can't turn to the executive branch because they run concentration camps and they don't like dissent. And the courts, well, they're pretty expensive, the lower courts, and the highest court is not on our side, to put it as tactfully as I can. So here we are headed for absolute disaster. And it is very apparent, and most thoughtful people I come across are pretty much aware of it. One thing, you know, the United States was always terribly good at business. Sometimes we were called materialistic and too much so, as opposed to spiritual other countries, not one of which I have ever visited, but I assume there must be some. But we are materialistic, and business is our business. Well, look at the debts that we have run up. We can't pay the cost of this war day by day without borrowing money, and nobody wants to buy our treasury bonds. Or will we have the money in the future to service those bonds by paying the interest on the debts? Now I see there's a whole raft of pieces coming out in the press saying it is quite clear that the future, that I've been writing this for many years, that the future now belongs to India, China, and Japan. They have the money. We've outsourced everything, including, it seems to me, the telephone companies, to these countries to help us out, or to sometimes to buy our treasuries, buy our goods. But we don't seem to make much of anything anymore. So we are outsourced. We are non-productive. We are deeply in debt. And now we're going to go to war against Iran, a brilliant culture, by the way, that we know nothing about because education is considered, you know, just not the thing. So we don't know about other countries. But Persia was one of the greatest civilizations that ever came forth on the planet. And they are smart, and they have atomic weapons. Now we're pretending, as we pretended with Iraq, that they're longing to blow us up because we're so prosperous and we have liberty and freedom and democracy. None of these things that we do have, but nevertheless, that's the official line for the administration. They've never explained why it was, if Saddam Hussein had had these weapons, which he did not have, why he would want to blow us up. Now, we know why Osama bin Laden hit us, because he wrote a lot of editorials to that effect and sent us lots of unpleasant messages why he hated us. It was on religious grounds. He's a religious zealot, and he was doing a religious job. We're doing a job for the oil and gas business, and that is the people who are making money out of this, and God knows how it is going to end, but we, the American people, are going to be the losers.
One of the key elements of U.S. policy is torture. You have the memorandum written by Alberto Gonzalez and assisted by the counsel for Vice President Richard Cheney. Does that indicate a new relationship of the United States with the world in terms of winning friends and influencing people?
Well, it's pure barbarism. I mean, symbolically, it's interesting that regions of the United States are rejecting Darwin and evolution. Well, I can see why. We have a substantial minority in the United States which hasn't advanced much beyond the baboon. And these ignorant people are full of hatred of other people, particularly those brighter than they are, and would like to take vengeance on them. So it's nice that we're rejecting evolution, and we are meanwhile going back to the Stone Age with torture, the killing of innocent populations, attacking countries which have done us no harm. This is insupportable. I was watching on C-SPAN the other night. They showed inaugural addresses from Franklin Roosevelt to the president. And Roosevelt, needless to say, he's the American genius. And he spoke of everything from Social Security, or intimated it. But it starts with Truman. Truman is starting to talk about a terrible enemy. And he followed Roosevelt, as we remember. And Truman is already starting the Cold War because the United States, our rulers at that time, Roosevelt has just died and had made some agreements with Stalin and Russia, which might have kept the world quite peaceful and we could have avoided the Cold War. Well, Truman got rid of those because he had been convinced by certain people who'd made a lot of money out of the war that we should be forever armed, perpetually at war for a perpetual peace. So there we are on top of the world, economically, militarily. We have the atomic bomb. Nobody else has it. And here is Harry Truman. Got to watch out. There's this godless, atheistic nation out there that that wants world conquest. Well, the Russians, you know, didn't want much of anything then except to recover the 20 million people that they had killed in World War II. They weren't going anywhere, but we saw to it that they would arm. We saw to it they'd be frightened. We saw to it that they became enemies. So we've been creating enemies ever since. And now we're taking on 1 billion Muslims. Isn't that brilliant? Just really brilliant. Yeah, 1 billion people who will hate us. And it'll take several generations for them to get over that.
Well, there is a social transformation that is promised by the Bush administration. Poof. Democracy. Democracy as a tool of the United States foreign policy and statecraft is the proclaimed basis of these spreading wars. What is your assessment of that claim, and do you believe that it's possible for the Bush administration to export democracy to the United States?
Well, since the United States has never been a democracy, and since the Founding Fathers did not want a democracy, I say this to the wonder sometimes of many audiences, but the word democracy does not appear in our Constitution. We are a republic, and a rather conservative republic interested in, at the beginning, in white men of property having a safe place to do business in. Later, the franchise is spread, but we are not a democracy. These elections, why is it that most of our people don't want to vote? They know that they don't have anything to vote for. In the end, Kerry sounded just like Bush. They were both in favor of the war. Now, the one thing that the governor of Vermont proved was that there was a huge anti-war party. The Americans have always, we as a people, believed in minding our own business, not in attacking other countries. We had enough to do at home and so on. This has all been imported, and this all comes out of corporate America, out of a ghastly educational system, and we now have a government which is not only not representative of the American people, even as republics go, but nowhere near a democracy. But democracy is a nice word. It's like ketchup. You can put it on everything. We are bringing democracy to Iraq, and we'll bring it to Iran, and one day it may actually come to the United States, but I don't think any of us will live that long.
Your knowledge, your education, and social exposure has given you a familiarity with American history that is rarely paralleled. And I'm wondering if you can look back over your knowledge of prior presidents and administrations and put George W. Bush in context and compare him to where we are today and where other presidential leaders have been.
I don't see that you can compare him. He doesn't come out of any political system that we've ever tried before. He wasn't elected the first time around in the year 2000. That was a faked election, and he was brought in by corrupt practices. He may have been the second time, or he may not have, but whatever it was, the presidential election was not fought on any issues. The war, the morality of the war, and the wisdom of the war, and the wisdom of our techniques used against foreigners, like torture and concentration camps, none of this was part of the public debate. We were talking about abortion, homosexual marriages. Aren't these great topics? These are really great topics for a great people on the march with atomic weapons to be discussing. There was so much really to talk about, and neither Kerry nor Bush was about to do it, and they both approved of the war because their advisors, certainly Kerry's advisors, had told him that. The result is, we are going on. I had a title of a little book called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. I didn't know how prophetic that title was. This is perpetual war. And after Iran, we'll make Russia angry at us, or somebody else out there. God help us if we make China angry at us. There are much more of them than there are of us. This war will end in our defeat, and that is why I want us to get out of it. I want us to bring the troops home, and I want us to try and invent an educational system so that really maniacs don't get in charge of the levers of power.
Bringing this back home to domestic policy, Gore Vidal, we have an election in which the president ran on the fears of conservative pockets of voters, on a platform of homophobia, even though he does claim to have a mandate. To round out our assessment, can you look at what you think the administration means in terms of domestic policy?
It's the last gold rush. It was 1849, I think. I'm out here in California as I speak to you. California filled up with people because they discovered gold. and the gold rush was on. Well, the gold rush is now on. Now, the last pile of gold in the United States is the money that we have given, since the age of 16, which is quite a long time ago. It's when I first worked and paid Social Security. The gold rush is for the bankers and the brokers and the people with mutual funds can get their hands on Social Security money. So you begin with a series of lies, the way they began the Iraq war. Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons. He's going to use them immediately. We've got to act fast. Stop him. So people fell for that. Now we hear 2018, Social Security, there won't be any money left. We've got to start to fix it now. We'll privatize it. What does that mean? We'll hand all the money in Social Security over to Wall Street. They'll invest it for you and every man a king. You will end up a rich capitalist, which is the dream of every good American. Well, you're going to end up a very poor capitalist because they're going to take that money. They will lose it as they always do. I've never known any boom, certainly a bubble as big as this one would be, that doesn't break. It is totally impractical. It cannot work. All we have to do is look across the water at Great Britain. Thanks to Mrs. Thatcher, they tried something like that too, privatizing a certain amount of retirement money for people of modest means as they got older. They found out they've lost all the money. Well, the money just didn't hold up. It couldn't bear up with the changes in the marketplace. That's very well known. Not that our media would tell us, because our media is totally corrupt. It's owned by the same people who are in the gold rush. So they're going to keep telling us, oh, Social Security's finished. It's just absolutely finished. We've got to go privatize it. And they'll talk about the great success in England, where it's a disaster. And the British are talking about our Social Security system as it now works as being the ideal. Simultaneously, our president, acting for his wealthy friends on Wall Street, is telling us that it's about to fail. Well, it's doing quite well, and the only danger to it is not going to be underpopulation of workers. It is going to be people like Bush and Cheney. They are gold rush people, and this is the gold mine.
Some people, given the cognitive dysfunction of the government and of the current administration, are driven to scream. You are driven to write, and I'm wondering what message in a bottle you might leave for future sanity squads who rummage through the rubble of our contemporary times.
Do as our ancestors said, not as we did.
Extraordinary. Gore Vidal. This is Pacifica Radio's coverage of the inauguration of George W. Bush.
I first spoke here in 1961, and I have mixed feelings about the press, as everybody does, but you are the most wonderful audience because you eat lunch faster than any group that I have ever talked to. I mean, it is such a joy. It's just over like that. And we can get down to the really serious stuff about Monica and Kathleen's correspondence, to really important subjects. But before we get to that, I plan just a little foreplay here about the origins of the American Empire and the meaning of the Cold War, how it started, who started it, who benefited. Because here we are at the 20th century, and the second Christian millennium are heading hand in hand for the exit. Personally, I thought they'd never go, without taking us with them. We've still got about 700 more days, so fingers are crossed. We all know that centuries and millennia are just arbitrary markings, a bit like the bookkeeping at Paramount Pictures. I see some of you have made movie sales. But symbolically, they mean a lot to those who are interested in why we are today what we are and doing what we are doing. This goes particularly for the one indisposable, or did the president say indispensable, nation on earth, and the last self-styled global empire loaded down with nukes, bases, and debts. I should note here that I have now lived through nearly three quarters of this century. I enlisted in the Army of the United States at 17, went to the Pacific, did nothing useful. I was just there, as Richard M. Nixon used to say, when the bombs were falling. Actually, the bombs are not really falling on either one of us. I was writing a novel, and he was making a fortune playing poker. Now, suddenly, it's 1998. I never thought I'd see that happen. And last year, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan. Also, more ominously, last July 26th, was the 50th anniversary of the National Security Act that, without any national debate or the people's consent, replaced the old American Republic with a national security state very much in the global empire business, which explains, but first let us get into the time machine. It is the Ides of August, 1945. Germany and Japan have surrendered, and some 13 million Americans are headed home to enjoy, well, the bottom line was always being alive. Home turned out to be a sort of fairground where fireworks go off and the band plays Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, and an endlessly enticing funhouse flings open its doors and we file through. We enjoy halls of mirrors where everyone is comically distorted, ride through all the various tunnels of love and take scary tours of horror chambers where skeletons and cobwebs and bats brush past us. And suitably chilled and thrilled, we're ready for the exit in everyday life. But, to the consternation of some and the apparent indifference of the rest, we were never really allowed to leave the funhouse. It has become a permanent part of our world, as were those goblins sitting under the apple tree. Officially, the United States was at peace. Much of Europe and most of Japan were in ruins, often literally, certainly economically. We alone had all our cities and a sort of booming economy, sort of, because it depended on war production. And there was, as far as anyone can tell, no war in the offing. Briefly, the arts flourished. It looked like it was going to be a golden age. Glass Menagerie was staged. Copland's Appalachian Spring was played. A film called The Lost Weekend, not a bad title for what we'd gone through, won an Academy Award, and the as yet unexiled Richard Wright published a much admired work, Black Boy. While Edmund Wilson's Memoirs of Heckett County was banned for obscenity in parts of the country, though it would be allowed out today in Washington, D.C. Quaintly, each city had at least three or four daily newspapers, while New York, as befitted the world's capital, had 17 newspapers. But a novelty television had begun to appear in household after household, its cold, gray, distorting eye relentlessly projecting a funhouse view of the world. Those who followed the ugly new minted word media began to note that often while watching television, we kept fading in and out of a chamber of horrors. Our ally in the recent war, Uncle Joe Stalin, as the accidental President Harry S. Truman called him, was growing horns and fangs that dripped blood. On Earth, we were the only great unruined power with atomic weapons, yet we were somehow at terrible risk. Why? How? The trouble appeared to be over Germany, which on February 11th, 1945, had been split at the Yalta summit, meeting into four zones, American, Soviet, British, and French. As the Russians had done the most fighting and suffered the greatest losses, it was agreed that they should have an early crack at reparations from Germany to the extent of $20 billion. At a later meeting at Potsdam, the new president, Truman, with Stalin and Churchill, reconfirmed Yalta and opted for the unification of Germany under the four victorious powers. But something had happened between the euphoria of Yalta and the edginess of Potsdam. As the meeting progressed, the atom bomb was tried out successfully in a New Mexico desert. We were now able to incinerate Japan, or the Soviet for that matter, and we no longer needed Russian help to defeat Japan. We started to renege on our agreements with Stalin, particularly reparations from Germany. We also quietly shelved the notion, agreed upon at Yalta, of a united Germany under four power control. Our aim now was to unite the three western zones of Germany and integrate them into our Western Europe, restoring in the process Germany's economy, hence fewer reparations. Then, as of May 1946, we began to rearm Germany. Stalin went up the wall at this betrayal. The Cold War was on. At home, the media was beginning to prepare the attentive few for disappointment. Suddenly, we were faced with the highest personal income taxes in American history to pay for more and more weapons, among them the world killer hydrogen bomb. Why? Because the Russians were coming. No one knew quite why they were coming or with what. Weren't they still burying 20 million dead? Official explanations for all this made very little sense. But then, as Truman's Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, merrily observed, in the State Department, we used to discuss how much time that mythical average American citizen put in each day listening, reading, and arguing about the world outside his country. It seemed to us that 10 minutes a day would be a high average. So why bore the people? Secret bipartisan government is best for what, after all, is or should be a society of docile workers, enthusiastic consumers, obedient soldiers who will believe just about anything for at least 10 minutes. The national security state, the NATO alliance, the 40 years Cold War were all created without the consent, much less the advice of the American people. Of course, there were elections during the crucial time, but Truman, Dewey, Eisenhower, Stevenson, Kennedy, Nixon were of a single mind as to the desirability of inventing first a many-tentacled enemy, communism, the star of the Chamber of Horrors, then to combat so much evil, install a permanent wartime state at home, with loyalty oaths, a national peacetime draft, and secret police to keep watch over homegrown traitors, as the few enemies of the national security state were known. Then followed 40 years of mindless wars, which created a debt of $5 trillion that hugely benefited aerospace and firms like General Electric, whose longtime TV spokesman, Ronald Reagan, was eventually retired to the White House. Why go into all of this now? Have we not done marvelously well as the United States of amnesia? Certainly European bankers, envious, our powerless labor unions. Only 14% of the lucky funsters are privileged to belong to a labor union. And our industries, lean, mean, downsized, with no particular place for the redundant to go, except into the hell of sizzle and fry and burn. Today, we give orders to every country on our globe, tell them with whom to trade and to which of our courts they must show up for indictment should they disobey us. Yet something ominous, as Daryl Zanuck used to say, no one ever corrected him either. Something really ominous is happening. We have come to what Tennessee Williams once called a moon of pause. When I asked him, what on earth does that mean, Tennessee? It is, he said loftily, the actual Greek translation of menopause. I said that the word moon did not come from menses, Latin, not Greek for month. Then what, he asked suspiciously, is the Latin for moon? And I told him it was luna and all the fun that he might have. With the word lunatic, he sighed and cut. But suddenly, summer before last, at the Madrid conference about the extension of NATO, which Senator Lott has just said is of no interest for a debate in the Senate, a moon of pause seemed a nice dotty phrase for the change of life that our empire is now going through with no enemy and no discernible function. While we were at our busiest in the funhouse, no one ever told us what the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was really about. March 17, 1948, the Treaty of Brussels called for a military alliance of Britain, France, Benelux to be joined by the U.S. and Canada on March 23rd. The impetus behind NATO was the United States, whose principal foreign policy since the administration of George Washington was to avoid entangling alliances. Now, as the Russians were supposed to be coming, we replaced the old republic with a newborn national security state and set up shop as the major European power west of the Elbe. We were now hell-bent on the permanent division of Germany between our western zone plus the French and British zones and the Soviet sector to the east. Serenely, we broke every agreement that we had made with our former ally, now horrendous communist enemy. For those interested in the details, Carolyn Eisenberg's, she happens to be in the room now, I'm told, Drawing the Line, the American Decision to Divide Germany, 1944-49, is a masterful survey of an empire, sometimes blindly, sometimes brilliantly, assembling itself first its allies, and turning them and its enemies like Germany, Italy, Japan, into client states, permanently subject to our military and economic diktat. Although the Soviets still wanted to live by our original arrangements at Yalta and even Potsdam, we had decided unilaterally to restore the German economy in order to enfold a rearmed Germany into Western Europe, thus isolating the Soviet, a nation which had not recovered from the Second World War and had no nuclear weapons. It was Dean Acheson again who elegantly explained all the lies that he was obliged to tell Congress and the 10-minute attention span the average American. This is gorgeous stuff, I think. If we did make our points, this is Acheson writing in his memoirs, if we did make our points clearer than truth, Is that glorious? Clearer than true. We did not differ from most other educators and could hardly do otherwise. Qualification must give way to simplicity of statement, nicety and nuance, to bluntness, almost brutality in carrying home a point. Thus were two generations of Americans conditioned by their overlords so that at the word communism, there is a Pavlovian reflex as the brain goes totally dead. In regard to the enemy, Ambassador to Moscow, Walter Bedell Smith, wrote in December 1947, apropos a conference to regularize European matters. The difficulty, he wrote, under which we labor, is that in spite of our announced position, we really do not want nor intend to accept German unification in any terms the Russians might agree to, even though they seem to meet most of our requirements. This is higher diplomacy. Hence Stalin's frustration that led to the famous blockade of the Allied section of Berlin, overcome by General Lucius Clay's successful airlift. As Eisenberg writes, with the inception of the Berlin blockade, President Truman articulated a simple story that featured the Russians trampling the wartime agreements in their ruthless grab for the former German capital. The president did not explain that the United States had abandoned Yalta and Potsdam, that it was pushing the formation of a West German state against the misgivings of many Europeans, and that the Soviets had launched the blockade to prevent partition. This was funhouse politics at its most tragical. The case for an American world empire was never properly argued since the debate, what little there was, centered on the alleged desire of the Soviet Union to conquer the whole world, just as Hitler and the Nazis were trying to do until stopped in 1945. On March 12, 1947, Truman addressed Congress to proclaim what would be known as the Truman Doctrine, in which he targeted our ally of 2 years earlier as the enemy. The subject at hand was a civil war in Greece, supposedly directed by the Soviet. We could not tolerate this as suddenly, this is his quotation, the policy of the United States is to support free peoples who are resisting attempted suppression of personal freedom. Thus, Truman made the entire world the specific business of the United States. Although Greek insurgents were getting some help from Bulgaria and Yugoslavia, the Soviet gave none. Russia stayed out. They still hoped that the British, whose business Greece had been, would keep order. But as Britain had neither the resources nor the will, they called on the U.S. to step in. Behind the usual closed doors, Acheson was stirring up Congress with Iago-like intensity. Russian pressure of some sort, he said, has brought the Balkans to the point where a highly possible Soviet breakthrough might open three continents to Soviet penetration. Senators gasped, grew pale, wondered how to get more defense contracts into their states. Of the major politicians, only former Vice President Henry Wallace dared answer Truman's clearer-than-truth version of history. Wallace said, yesterday, March 12, 1947, marked a turning point in American history, for it is not a Greek crisis that we face. It is an American crisis. Yesterday, President Truman proposed, in effect, that America police Russia's every border. There is no regime too reactionary for us, provided it stands in Russia's expansionist path. There is no country too remote to serve as the scene of a contest, which may widen until it becomes a world war. 9 days after Truman declared war on communism, he installed a federal loyalty oath program. All government employees must now swear allegiance to the new order. Henry Wallace struck again. The president's executive order creates a master index of public servants, from the janitor in the village post office to the cabinet members. They are to be sifted and tested and watched and appraised. Truman was nervously aware that many regarded Wallace as true heir to Roosevelt's New Deal. Wallace was also likely to enter the presidential race of 1948. Truman now left truth behind in the dust. Here's his quote. The attempt of Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin et al. To fool the world and the American Crackpots Association, represented by Joe Davies, Henry Wallace, Claude Pepper, and the actors and artists in immoral Greenwich Village. It's just like Hitler's and Mussolini's so-called socialist states. Give them hell, Harry. In the wake of Truman's cuckoo-like emergence from the old-fashioned closet of the American Republic, a new American state was being born in order to save the nation and the great globe itself from communism. The nature of this militarized state was from the beginning beyond rational debate. Characteristically, Truman and Acheson insisted on closed hearings of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. These matters were too important to share with a people whose spare 10 minutes was now more and more filling up with television. The media spoke with a single voice. Time Life publisher Henry Luce said it loudest. God has founded America as a global beacon of freedom. He once said to me, the great task for the United States in the American century is the Christianization of China. I remember thinking then we were really in trouble. It's before I knew this background, which is now coming out. Dissenters like Wallace were labeled communists and ceased to engage meaningfully in public life. An ancestral voice in his own time, he spoke on May 21st, 1947. Today, in blind fear of communism, we are turning aside from the United Nations. We are approaching a century of fear. And thus far, he's proved to be half right. On July 26, 1947, Congress enacted the National Security Act, which created the National Security Council, still going strong, and the Central Intelligence Agency, still apparently going over a cliff as the result of decades of bad intelligence, not to mention all those cheery traitors for whom the country club at Langley, Virginia was once an impenetrable cover. When the original North American Treaty Organization was Atlantic was created, only the Augustus Monquet de Gaulle got the point of what we were doing. He took France out of our Cosa Nostra and developed his own atomic bomb. But France was still very much linked to the Imperium, though through the CIA and other secret forces. Political control was exerted within the empire, not only driving the Labour Prime Minister Harold Wilson around a bend too far, but preventing Italy from ever having a cohesive government by not allowing the historic compromise, a government of Christian Democrats and communists. The Soviet, always reactive, promptly cracked down on their client states, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, East Germany, and a wall went up in Berlin to spite their face, not ours. From 1950 to 1990, Europe was dangerously divided and armed to the teeth. But as American producers of weapons were never richer, all was well with their world. At Yalta, Roosevelt wanted to break up the European colonial empires, particularly that of the French. Of Indochina, FDR said, France has milked it for 100 years. For the time being, he proposed a UN trusteeship. Then he died. Unlike Roosevelt, Truman was not a philatelist. Had he been a stamp collector, he might have known where the various countries in the world were and who lived in them. Like every good American, he knew he hated communism. He also hated socialism, which may or may not have been the same thing. No one was ever quite sure. Yet as early as the American election of 1848, socialism, imported by comical German immigrants with noses always in books, was an ominous specter, calculated to enrage a raw capitalist society with labor unions, health care, and other devil's work, still being fiercely resisted a century and a half later. In 1946, when Ho Chi Minh asked the United States to take Indochina under its wing, Truman said, "No way, you're some kind of Fu Manchu communist, the worst." In August 1945, Truman told de Gaulle that the French could return to Indochina. We were no longer FDR anti-imperialists. As Ho had his Northern Republic, the French installed Bao Dai in the South. February 1st, 1950, the State Department, of all places, came to this extraordinary conclusion. This is their report. "The choice confronting the United States is to support the French in Indochina or face the extension of communism over the remainder of the continental area of Southeast Asia and possibly further westward. Thus, without shepherds or even a napalm star, the domino theory was born in a humble State Department manger." On May 8, 1950, Acheson recommended economic and military aid to the French in Vietnam. By 1955, the U.S. was paying 40% of the French cost of that war. For a quarter century, the United States was to fight in Vietnam because our ignorant leaders and their sharp-eyed financiers never realized that the game is not dominoes, but chess. Happily, nothing ever stays the same. During the last days of the waning moon, a haphazard Western European Economic Union has been cobbled together. Then, as the Soviet, demonstrating its pure viciousness, abruptly folded, the two Germanies, leaving us high and dry and petulant, the two Germanies that we had so painstakingly kept apart reunited. Washington was suddenly adrift, and in the sky the moon of empire paused. Neither Reagan nor Bush had much knowledge of history or geography. Nevertheless, orders still kept coming from the White House, but they were less and less heeded because everyone knew that the Oval One had a bank overdraft of $5 trillion, and he could no longer give presents to good clients or wage war without first passing the hat to the Germans and the Japanese, as he was obliged to do when Ted Turner had his light show for CNN in the Persian Gulf. Gradually, it is now becoming evident to even the most distracted funster that there is no longer any need for NATO because there is no enemy. One might say there never really was one, even when NATO was started. But over the years, we did succeed in creating a pretty dangerous Soviet, a funhouse mirror version of ourselves. Although the United States may yet, in support of Israel, declare war on 1 billion Muslims, the Europeans will stay out of that one. They recall 1529, when Turks besieged Vienna, not as obliging guest workers, but as world conquerors. Never again. The time has now come for the Europeans to free themselves of their American masters. Our motive for hanging on to empire is obvious. With an expanded NATO, our arms makers, if not workers, are in for a bonanza. As it is, American sale of weapons went up 23% last year, while restrictions on sales to Latin America are being lifted. Chile, ever menaced by Ecuador, plans to buy 24 F-16 jet fighters. But it is an expanded NATO that causes true joy in the boardrooms. Upon joining NATO, the lucky new club member is obliged to buy expensive weapons from the likes of Lockheed Martin, recently merged with Northrop Grumman. Since the new members have precarious economies and the old ones are not exactly booming. The American taxpayer, a wan goose that lays few eggs, will have to borrow even more money to foot the bill, which the Congressional Budget Office says should come to $125 billion over 15 years, with the U.S. paying most of it. Yeltsin correctly sees this as a hostile move against Russia, not to mention an expensive renewal of the Cold War. There comes a moment when empires cease to exert energy and become symbolic or existential, as we used to say back in the 40s. The current wrangling over NATO demonstrates what a quandary a symbolic empire is in when it wants to maintain its view of itself at home and abroad, and yet lacks the mind, much less the resources, to impose its hegemony upon its former client states. Happily, in the absence of money and common will, nothing much will probably happen. Meanwhile, there's a new and better world ready to be born. The optimum economic unit in the world is now the city-state. Thanks to technology, everyone knows or can know something about everyone else on the planet. The message now pounding in over the internet is the irrelevancy, not to mention the sheer danger of the traditional nation-state, much less empire. Currently, the warlord bankers at Peking are tolerating not only vigorous semi-autonomies like Shanghai, but they are enjoying Hong Kong for the present. We may not like the way Singapore is run, though we seem to be imitating their politics by suing in the courts our political enemies, thus breaking them. But it is, relatively speaking, a greater commercial success, perhaps even than the United States. In the next century, barring accident, the common euro market will evolve not so much into a union of ancient blood-stained states as a mosaic of homogeneous regions like the Spanish, French, Basques, or city-states like Milan, each loosely linked in trade with a clearinghouse information center at Brussels. They would orchestrate finance and trade and the policing of cartels. Basques, Bretons, Walloons, Scots, who want to be rid of onerous nation-states, should be let to go in order to pursue and even, why not, overtake happiness, the goal, or so we Americans have always pretended to believe, of the human enterprise. So on that predictably sententious American note, I am tempted to enjoin the movers and shakers of this world to recall the Greek doctor's oath, above all, do no harm. Hippocrates also wrote, and this goes for the moved and the shaken of the world, life is short, but the art is long, the opportunity fleeting, the experiment perilous, the judgment difficult.